The Tom Woods Show, episode 2309.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Hey, everybody. I'm giving away three free courses from my Liberty Classroom. One of them is ex-Marxist Michael Rechtenwald teaching you about critical theory so you can understand leftism and fight it better, as well as our course on how Alexander Hamilton screwed up America and the history of the conservative and libertarian movements. Check it out at 3freecourses.com. Hey, everybody. Tom Woods here. I'm delighted today to welcome Aaron Brown, who teaches statistics at NYU and the University of California at San Diego. Quite a gig that must be. But in particular, I want to talk about a very, very interesting and important and completely convincing article he just wrote for Reason magazine. And it's called The Statistically Flawed Evidence That Social Media is Causing the Teen Mental Health Crisis. And it's primarily a response to Jonathan Haidt, who's also at NYU, whom I've had on this program. And anyway, Gene Epstein, who runs the Soho Forum debate series in New York City, said, you really should talk to Aaron Brown. He's a very, very impressive guy. I've heard him, and I've just read this article, and I think what he's talking about needs to be discussed. So, Aaron Brown, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Thomas.
I like the tone of this article, first of all. You say, look, Jonathan Haidt seems to be a fairly decent scholar and a well-intentioned guy, and he's not a hack or anything, but I just think he's fallen into an error here for whatever reason. And let me run through and just give you the black and white of the situation. I don't know why 99% of writers are incapable of taking that tone these days, but it was a refreshing throwback to like the 1980s or something to see an article that was written like that, because I too have rather a soft spot for Jonathan Haidt. And I'll tell you, before I read your article, I think I probably would have assumed that there could be some correlation, and you're not denying that there could be some correlation, by the way, between social media use and teenage depression. But you're saying that if there is such a correlation, if there is such a connection, it hasn't been demonstrated up to now. I'd like to start with some things you say at the beginning that will seem controversial to some people, but to many people who are in the know, I think they will give you a knowing nod, let's say, because you seem skeptical of a lot of, let's say, the way academic research is carried out and how robust the conclusions are in a lot of academic papers. Now, why is that?
Well, first of all, I want to echo your appreciation for Jonathan Haidt. I've read many of the things he's written over the years, and he's always entertaining, and he's very often insightful and right. And most of his work relies on high-quality, robust studies that he's clearly read carefully and understood. What he's done here is he's pulled together 301 mostly really bad, embarrassingly bad studies that I don't think he's read very carefully. He can't have, because he's too smart to have accepted this and come to a completely erroneous conclusion. I agree it is very well, first of all, let's just go back. Social media use has exploded since around 2010. And we have to think about the consequences. For many people, including most younger people, it is not all uncommon to spend 3 or 4 hours a day on social media. Now, that's reading tweets, that's posting Instagram, that's posting your selfies on various platforms. But that's an enormous amount of free time. You take away sleep and work and school and eating, you know, that's a huge chunk of free time. And it has to have profound social and psychological effects. There's just no doubt about it. Some are good, some are bad. And it is entirely possible that it is one of the reasons more teenage girls are depressed than were in 2010. But that's a tiny fraction of its overall effects. And the kind of studies in this, of the ones Jonathan Haidt brought together, just can't tell us anything useful about it. But what he has done that is so useful and so rare is he put his stuff on the internet in a Google Doc and organized it. And that means I can go head to head and say, okay, this study is wrong, this study is bad. And
Normally, you can't do that. On most issues, everything is muddled. People say, I have studies that prove this. And somebody says, that study is bad. And somebody else says, well, that doesn't matter because there's this other study. So by organizing thing, I believe Jonathan Hyde has put us on a process where we are going to find the right answer to this, unlike so many other issues.
I feel like he's got to reckon with, I mean, we haven't yet gotten into what your critiques are, but I feel like he's got to reckon with what you've come up with here, given that he is, as you say in the article, moving forward with a book on teen mental health next year. If he doesn't reckon with this, that's a big problem.
I think so. I mean, I hope he will. And then we can move forward. And he'll say, no, some of these studies are good, or he'll have some other reason, I hope. And we can move forward. And I could be wrong. I'm wrong a lot.
Well, I would, though, like to say a little something, though, about abstracting from Jonathan Haidt and instead just looking at academic research in general. You look at a lot of it with a jaundiced eye. You're skeptical of it. You say that a lot of it is guilty of what you call statistical malpractice. Why do you think that is?
First of all, there is, unfortunately, a tremendous amount of egregious fraud. People who are just lying, making up data. And institutions close ranks and protect them rather than investigate. And we know that although there are hundreds and hundreds of cases that come to light every year, and that's the tiny minority. There's got to be a lot more. But that's not the big problem. The big problem is, let's say you're a social psychologist and you're a good one and you're working on something, but it's a hard problem. It might be 10 years before you really have good, useful results that are clear and definite. So you're doing this work and you're also teaching your classes, you're on university committees, you're taking training courses for sexual harassment and IT security, and you're on committees. So you don't have a lot of time and you need publications. You don't get your publications, you're not getting promoted, you lose your job, and you can't tell granters. Somebody gives you $25,000 to study something and you go back to them in a year and say, well, you know, I learned some stuff, but I don't have a clear publication out of it. You'll never get another grant. So what you got to do is you got to put out cheap, easy studies. So you pull your sophomore psychology class, you run it through a statistics package, and you publish a paper. Or you send random email surveys on the internet, or you find 20 random people and you ask them, get off social media for a week and then tell me how you feel. This is clearly useless research. It could be done in an hour or a couple of hours anyway. It doesn't tell you anything meaningful about anything, but it gets you a publication. And sometimes I'm talking about respectable journals. I'm not talking about stuff that's just posted online. And it goes through peer review, but all the peer reviewers are in the same boat. And so you just get this stuff. Sometimes you can do good work, but almost nobody can do good work at the publication rate demanded by grantors and universities. So what you do, you take the same research, you package it, and you put it in four different articles. You get some bad data set that you just downloaded online, and you run 20 statistical analyses out of it and get papers. You put like four or five co-authors on every paper because everybody gets credit that way, even though it looks like one person could have done this in an afternoon. And this is the majority of published research is of this type, of somebody needed a publication. Some of it might be good, some of it, but it certainly doesn't have to be to get published. So you have this vast array. And the key thing is nobody, not the journal editors, not the peer reviewers, are looking at the logical case. All they're looking at is the statistical p-value, which is what the p-value tells you is the conclusion this article are not random chance. But if you don't have a logical case, it doesn't really matter whether it's random chance or not. And p-values are easily hacked. There are all kinds of ways to get random data that tells you nothing and to get a good p-value. So that's what it is, and it's a big problem.
I'd like to read a particularly bold paragraph from this article, if I may. I'm going to have the article linked, by the way, on our show notes page. That's tomwoods.com/2309. And the paragraph I have in mind is this one. Academics face strong career pressures to publish flawed research, and publishing on topics in the news, such as social media and teen mental health, can generate jobs for researchers and their students, like designing depression avoidance policies for social media companies, testifying in lawsuits, and selling social media therapy services. This causes worthless areas of research to grow with self-reinforcing peer reviews and meta-analyses, suck up grant funds, create jobs, help careers, and make profits for journals. Well, that's rather more mundane than the mission of the university that is generally set before us.
And let me say here, I know a lot of academics, and most of them are honest, sincere, smart people trying to do good work. But they got no choice but to throw out these kind of bad studies. It's a little bit like politicians. You know, there are sincere politicians really working for things, but they got to kiss babies, they got to make stupid speeches, they got to have opinions on things they know nothing about. It's just sort of part of the dross of the career.
Let's get into, obviously, in the article, you discuss a few example studies, given that there are 301. But talk to us as somebody who does statistics for a living, talk to a lay audience about how it is you take your trained eye, look at a study like one of these, and know that it's flawed.
Okay, well, the first thing is not statistical at all. The first thing you do is you look, what is the logical case these people are arguing? And in most cases, it just clearly can't be true. For example, one study asked psychology students at a elite Eastern university to limit their social media to 10 minutes a day for 3 weeks. And then they gave them a survey about how do you feel, how often do you feel sad, how often do you feel lonely, that kind of thing. And they said there was a significant decline in depression among the people who were asked to stop. Now, that can't be true. Being asked, you're a freshman psychology student at this university, and somebody asks you to limit your social media use to 10 minutes a day. And by the way, they have very limited means of monitoring whether you actually did that. 3 weeks later, you might feel a little better. You might feel that you got more stuff done. You weren't wasting so much time looking at cat videos or something. But it clearly is not going to make any significant difference to the mental health of a functional individual. You are not studying what you're claiming to study. You're not studying how social media affects teenage girls. You're studying how getting rid of a time-wasting activity, or what for many people is something of a time-wasting activity, affects your mood.
Right. And not to mention, I think you kind of hint at it, there's a kind of conflation here between your passing mood and whether you have clinical depression, which is a very different thing.
Absolutely. And another thing, this is less obvious, but Haidt actually discusses this. This is one of the things that makes his account so good. He says, the effect of social media may not be on the social media users. For example, social media might cause the teenage girl's peers to isolate her or bully her or something like that. She may not be on social media, but she may be suffering from it. So the amount of time you spend on social media is not what you're really trying to study. What I would say is, if you had a reasonable hypothesis, it would be there's some kind of toxic social media engagement. People who think about social media when they're not on it, people who worry about what other people say about them on social media. You're not really talking about social media screen time. So they're taking two variables that are not at all related to what you want to study. They're studying a population that is not teenage girls. I think most people who get into these elite universities, you know, they're older than the teenage girls, but you've probably selected away a lot of the depressed ones. A lot of depressed teenage girls are not getting into elite universities because they're sad, they're depressed, they don't have the energy to study or to deal with college life. So you're just completely missing the point. But let's go on. Okay, so let's put that aside. Let's just look at the statistics they did. Well, what we found out, and it's kind of hidden in the middle of the paper in some jargon that almost no one is going to read unless they read the paper carefully and know some statistics, that they had somehow assigned their depressed students to one of the two groups, to either the group that was asked to limit social media or one that was. They don't tell you which one it is. But either way, that completely invalidates the study, right? You can't look at the results if at the beginning of the study you put all the depressed people in the control group or all the depressed people in the treatment group. So the study is just clearly worthless for any kind of conclusion about depression and social media use just because of that statistical flaw. Then on top of all of that, it really looks fair. Here's where kind of my experience kicks in. There is a specific error people very, very commonly make. And I'll explain if you like, but you don't have to.
Is this the Raven paradox?
No, that is a different one. There's something called a Likert scale that a lot of these studies use. They ask you, you know, how often do you feel sad? never, rarely, sometimes, often, or always. And when you code that up, when you put that in your system, you usually give a 0 for never, 1 for rarely. But sometimes people do a 1 for never and a 2 for rarely. And people often mix that up. So that what you get is you get a scale where because you've shifted the 0 point, you just get numbers that don't reflect the actual responses on the scale. So what we see is all of these depressed people who were assigned to one of the two groups, their depression disappeared in 1 week. And that's the whole effect of everything. That's what drives all the statistical results in this study. And that has to be a coding error, right? That kind of stuff just never happens. So somebody coded it up. Instead of using a 0 for never, they used 1. Then it was corrected the next week. And I think that's what drove every result in the study. Now, I could be wrong about it. I mean, that's just a guess. That's speculation. But either way, if you look at the data, it just doesn't show there's like a steady increase in mood among a large population from being off social media. It shows there's this bang 1 week decline from people who were probably miscategorized at the beginning. And then finally, there's the size of the effect. These are tiny effects. These are tiny correlations. In this case, they said, well, if you spend 2.5 more hours a day on social media, then you move one notch on one of 24 scales. So I'm giving you 24 questions. How often do you feel sad? How often do you feel lonely? How often do you feel you're worthless? And you move one of those from a never to a rarely if you spend 2.5 more hours a day on social media. So that's saying the heaviest social media users are one notch more on one of 24 different scales. So that could not possibly explain the effect, the increase of teenage girls' use of social media. It's just orders of magnitude too small an effect. But it is statistically significant. They have a p-value, I think, based on a coding error. But even if it wasn't a coding error, they have a p-value that gets them published.
Hey, folks, quick sponsor message from our friends at CrowdHealth. Every month you have all kinds of payments you got to make, whether it's rent or your car or groceries, whatever. But every time you make that payment, you know exactly what you're getting in return. But with health insurance, you don't know what you're getting. Is this thing going to cover this? Is it going to cover that? Am I going to have a fight on my hands? What exactly am I entitled to? It's very opaque, and it almost seems like that's by design. But CrowdHealth is just the opposite. It's simple, transparent, and affordable. As a member, you'll get a personal care advocate to help navigate the complexities of health events. Your advocate will negotiate bills on your behalf. They'll be with you every step of the way. Could save you thousands in health bills in the process. You'll get access, indeed, to a crowd of thousands of other members who are ready to help pay for large health expenses. $40 of your $175 monthly payment helps pay for your care advocate, telemedicine services, discounted prescriptions, and other tools to get you the best care at an affordable price. And the remainder of that monthly payment goes into a CrowdHealth account that you own, so you can help others in the crowd pay for their medical expenses as well. So you'll notice that CrowdHealth is bringing back some semblance of cost accountability and free markets to the world of healthcare. We'll experience healthcare freedom with CrowdHealth. Visit joincrowdhealth.com/woods to get your first 3 months for just $99 per month. That's joincrowdhealth.com/woods. CrowdHealth is not health insurance. It's a totally different way of paying for healthcare. Terms and conditions may apply. Can you explain to us what a longitudinal study is and what you found when looking at the longitudinal studies on this subject?
Well, the problem with we have observational studies, you just say, well, are the heavy social media users depressed? The trouble with that is you can't tell about causality. You know, do they go on social media because they got depressed? Did they get depressed and then go on social media? Did some third factor affect both the depression and social media? With a longitudinal study, you study the same people over time. So you look at them every year and you ask the question, did the people who increased their social media use in 2020, did they increase their depression in 2021? And if that's true, there's a strong argument that the increase in social media caused the depression rather than the other way around. So that's the point of a longitudinal study. So it has some longitudinal studies there, but when you drill down, you find out they didn't do the longitudinal test. Some of them did longitudinal studies, but they studied depression and social media at the same time. They didn't look at which came first. In other studies, they didn't look at the same people. They just looked at group averages. So I think what's going on here is somebody told them you should do a longitudinal study. They learned in statistics class that these can be useful for establishing causality, but they either didn't understand what a longitudinal study is supposed to be, or they didn't get good results on the longitudinal question, so they just put in their associational questions instead.
There seems to be, what I glean from your piece also, is a problem of academics who need to publish writing articles on subjects where they kind of feel like they know what the answer should be. They go into it knowing what the answer should be. The answer should be that social media should be at least a moderate driver of depression in teenage girls. And so then they get a whole lot of noise statistically. They try to tease out of that noise something saying, oh, look, say my hypothesis is correct.
I tell you, Thomas, it's much, much worse than that. See, here's the trouble. In order to get published, they say you need a p-value of 5%. So what that means is there's less than a 5% chance your results are from random chance. So you get a database, and it's easy from any reasonably large database to make thousands and thousands of hypotheses to test. And 5% of the ones that aren't true, 5% of the time when there's no relation at all, you're going to get a statistically significant result. So let's say you study 1,000 hypotheses at a 5% level, so you've got 50 significant hypotheses you can publish. Now you look through them, and some of them are going to be ridiculous. People whose names start with the first half of the alphabet are more likely to go skydiving than people who aren't. So those are ridiculous. Nobody's going to believe them. There's no interest in them. Some of them are going to be obvious. Boys are taller than girls on average. When those are, you can't publish. So you go through, you look for something in between, something plausible, just unlikely enough that it's going to be clickbait if it's reported, but not so implausible people are going to laugh at you for saying it. So you come along, you know, social media use increases depression. Well, that's great. It's not obvious. People wouldn't know it for sure. It's newsworthy. Both social media and depression are in the news, and it's plausible. It could be true. So that's the one you publish. And a lot of these databases people were using, here's a red flag for you. A lot of people use databases that had been collected for other reasons. Like one of the studies took a data that had been collected for a drug and alcohol intervention program among middle school students in Canada and ran through it to see if they could get a publication on social media use and depression. And my guess is they got the data probably. I'm not sure of the ethics of this. These are middle school students. I'm not sure you're supposed to be passing their data around to random academics. But anyway, I'm sure it's legal. I'm sure they did the right paperwork. My guess is lots of people looked at this data because it's available. It's free. It's easy. They ran statistical tests on all kinds of probably thousands of hypotheses. And the ones that popped up that were interesting, in this case, social media and depression, that's the one that ended in a publication. And I have no doubt there are hundreds of other publications on these same data with other conclusions. But the problem is the ones that get selected are the ones that help your career, the ones that get in the media, so your university and media department likes you, the ones that have sort of career opportunities associated. You can now go to Twitter and say, you better hire me as a consultant or the government will shut you down. And those are the ones that get published.
This is, I think, going to be hard for a lot of people who might have had a rather more naive view of the way academic research is carried out. As hard for them to hear. And I was somebody who I have a PhD from Columbia, but I was in history, and generally the papers there are not trying to draw statistical correlations or anything. And, you know, either there was a coal miner's strike or there wasn't, you know, so I didn't run into quite so much of this.
By the way, though, let me stop you there. There is a whole field of quantitative history.
Oh, there is. I'm not in it, but there is.
Boat building in the UK correlated with opium trade in China or something like that. And a lot of that is very similar.
Well, how about this then? Maybe it would help people to follow even better. If you could describe for us, what would a paper have to look like for you, Aaron Brown, to walk away saying, I think there's at least good reason to think now on the basis of this, that there is some reasonably robust connection between depression among teen girls and their social media use?
Sure. The first thing you got to do, and this is a rule for any investigation, is study what you care about. We care about depressed teenage girls, so go find some. interview them, talk to them, listen to them, find out what they see, think their problems are, see how they are different from sort of nominally similar peers, their sister, the girl next door. And this is hard work. This is slow. This is the kind of research that doesn't lead to quick publications or promotions. But it's what psychologists should be doing, right? Psychologists are not statistics experts. They should be interviewing depressed people and non-depressed people as well. You know, go out and find out what is different from the two. Now, maybe in the course of this, you come up with something, you find out it's social media, but it won't be something vague and general like social media. It will be all of these girls woke up in the middle of the night thinking about something on social media, or all of these depressed girls, or many of them used one site versus another, or maybe they used them heavily for a while and then used them not at all. So whatever. Now you have a very specific hypothesis that is plausible because you've identified, you know, you've talked to real people and then you know what's the real mechanisms. That's the time to start doing statistics. Then you start go out and gather for your more specific hypothesis. You gather data from larger populations. And that data is not as detailed or complete as what you get from the subjects you study individually, but you have a lot more of it. And you can start doing statistical tests. Next, what I'd say is I want to see a 3-to-1 odds ratio. With these papers, many of these papers anyway, they express their conclusion in odds ratio. A heavy social media user is 1.3 times as likely to be depressed as a non-user, something like that. I want to see odds ratios of 3. I want to see a hypothesis. You can demonstrate there is 3 times the danger of something from a specific thing. And it might not be heavy social media users. It might be people who wake up in the middle of the night worrying about social media, or people whose friends are all heavy social media users. And if you can't find a 3-way, it's just my experience. It is just so easy to find these 30%, 1.3 or 1.8 odds ratios with random data. Everybody can do it in any field. They take any 2 things you want to study and you can find those kinds of odds ratios. So you have to refine your hypothesis to get a 3-to-1 odds ratio. Now you got something. But what you've got is a thread. It's not a conclusion. You've got a thread and you've got to pull on that thread and follow it and see how it weaves in and out until you really understand something. And that's how research should be progressing. But it's slow, it's expensive, it's frustrating. It doesn't give clickbait conclusions. You know, you find out, well, social media use is complicated and teenage girl depression is complicated and they're kind of related, but in complicated ways.
Yeah, right. So again, I can see why there would be a bias toward sexy results and maybe trying to get those results through means fair and foul. I like this, I guess it's part of your conclusion, but about Jonathan Haidt, you say, because I think this really expresses it very well. Haidt is a rigorous and honest researcher, but I fear that on this issue, he's been captured by a public health mindset. Rather than thinking of free individuals making choices, he's looking for toxins that affect fungible people measured in aggregate numbers. That leads to blaming social problems on bad things, rather than looking for the reasons people tend to use those things with their positive and negative consequences. Wow. I mean, well, of course, we've seen quite a bit of what the quote-unquote public health mindset can indeed be like when it goes wrong. So I would not want Haidt to fall into that.
Yeah, and I think, you know, we're libertarians, but even libertarians sometimes make exceptions for infectious diseases and sanitation, right? So you'll make the most egregious right violation. You'll quarantine a healthy person in a situation that will probably kill him, because you don't want an infectious disease to spread, or you know, your sanitation rules. But when people say, I want to treat, you know, gun violence as a public health problem, what they mean is we're going to identify a toxin, a thing, a gun, and we're going to outlaw it. And then we'll solve our problem. And we're going to treat people as faceless aggregates, so that we're not going to ask, was this gun killing a person defending himself against a criminal, or a criminal killing an innocent victim? We're just going to add up total gun deaths. Suicides, homicides, justifiable homicides, they all go in one thing. Or opioids. We're going to ban opioids because some people overdose. We're not going to ask, why did they take the drugs? Why do people overdose? Why do people kill themselves? We're going to just get rid of the opioid and that'll solve the problem. And in this case, we're not asking, why does social media contribute to teenage girl depression? We're just going to ban social media with all of its positive and negative effects. And on top of all of that, not only is that, you know, an egregious violation of libertarian principles, but it doesn't work. We know that prohibitions usually don't work and also often make problems worse. And having social media for 15 years and then getting rid of it is not the same as never having it before. Nobody knows what would happen if we went back to getting rid of it or driving it underground.
On this note, I want to, as I did make you a sort of a promise in terms of the time, so I want to urge people to check out your article, Aaron Brown's article on this subject that I have linked at tomwoods.com/2309. Do you have a Substack or anything like that where you write regularly?
I'm afraid I don't. I am not as much of a social media user or organized communication. I do write columns for Bloomberg. I do have a website and I put some things there, but I don't maintain an active presence on any site.
Oh, well, that's okay. Well, tell me what the website is.
E-Raider. E and then the word Raider, E-R-A-I-D-E-R.com.
Okay. I'll put that on our show notes page as well. Well, Aaron Brown, thank you so much for this. Obviously, people should read your article. It's a long one for Reason Magazine, but they should look at it carefully because it's not only for the specific subject matter, namely an alleged link between depression and social media use, but also I think as just an object lesson of sloppy academic work, the misuse of data, agenda-driven research. There's a lot here for people to take in. So thank you for that and for your time today.
Thank you, Thomas.
And thank you, ladies and gentlemen.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of the Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at podsworth.com.